All right, Kate. Kate was, I don't know if I prompted this, but she ended up listening to, on the timeline, the first time I was on the radio, which was October 1st, 1984, so 40 years ago, Chris Toomey, the avant-garde aesthete at CKLN, he's the one to ask me if I ever, we asked Chad, yes, Bob Marshall first, if we'd heard anything about the Church of Subgenius. That led to me talking to him, and then he said, "Well, so you're Bob. Let's do this on his show, which was called Word of Mouth. That was part of the spoken word department." So I got James Kidney, the Canadian actor, and Nelson Thal, the later called on the radio Tom Rich, take off on the Richie Rich comic books, comics series. Common character, and so he went on there, and Chris Toomey played, I don't know, 20 minutes or something of Subgenius tapes, and then we came on and started talking, basically led by me, and but Nelson and James Kidney responded pretty good. So I told Kate, if you listen to that, I didn't know if I'd ever be on the radio game. I crammed in as many ideas as possible. Lon McLuhan ideas. So I asked Kate to listen to it, and maybe she did it on her own, can't remember, but I asked her to listen to it again and note all the ideas I said, which many should be recognized by longtime listeners of stuff I repeated 100 times over the last 40 years. So Kate said she'd do that, and we're going to talk about them. So she's going to start telling some of the ideas that we recognized. I'm loud enough, Chad, here?
Yeah, sounds good, Bob.
Okay.
It's not quiet like before when you tried web call last week. This is good.
All right. Maybe it's because I'm sitting near it closer. Okay, you ready, Kate? You can start doing your inventory.
There was only about 15 or 20 minutes that you talked, and then I just wrote down all the things that you crammed in that are things that you say over and over for 40 years after this. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first thing you said was, "This evening is both extremely ecstatic and sad." And that's something you would say, that the world is sad and ecstatic.
Yeah.
So yeah. A fiction, Sato's here is this fiction called Canada. You said that Canada.
Wait. What did you said the Sappho or something?
I know. A lot of times.
Talk slowly. Initiate clearly. So how did you introduce the second point?
So this recording was, the audio wasn't the best. So sometimes you were mumbling or just sounded like that. So you said Satos. I don't know what you meant. But I just wrote down Satos because maybe that's a word I don't know.
Don't know yet. Then we'll come back to that.
Satos here in this fiction called Canada.
Maybe I addressed a politician.
Then you introduced your associate.
The main point is that I said this fiction called Canada.
Fiction called Canada. Yeah. And then you introduced your associate. Bob Box and Bob Locks.
Yeah.
And I guess you don't say that for 40 years after, but I thought that was funny.
Well, we would reminisce occasionally and say those names.
Mm-hmm. Plan for the Exodus Return. On July 5th, 1998, has sped up due to speed of light conditions we live under.
That's an interesting point because, I do in 1988, I talked to McLuhan and then Mae Brussels. For the first time, I talked to a dead person through the Evergreens. And so I decided to feature more of that. And I don't know if it was that, but it was something like that, something unique from the Evergreens. So I had to hide Michael's voice. He was channeling the Evergreens, Michael Blake Reed. He passed away in 2013, February 2013, born in 1938. But he wasn't sure if he wanted his voice out there or to be identified with the show or anything. So I came up with the idea that the Exus had landed early in February, March 88, or maybe late 88. I'm associating my election to seat council 10, maybe I'm mixing that up. That's in March 88. So by the end of 88, and I remember doing McLuhan and Mae Brussel late 88, so I started playing those excerpts, and I had to say they were something else than the Evergreens, so I said they were the Exus, and I said they landed, and 10 years before X Day, basically. So I had the advantage over staying and everybody. Now, what strikes me is I predicted they did. I didn't know that. Mm. I predicted they would land early. Was I saying that they had landed then?
You just said, plan for the Exodus return on July 5th, 1998 has been sped up due to the speed of light conditions we live under.
Good point. All right, so yeah, I've said
and
200
then,
years.
Right,
McLuhan
and then
said
right
we live 200
that.
Years every hold it. McLuhan said we live 200 years every 12 months. Back about 1971, I first heard him say it or read it somewhere. So I'm probably just making that point. I wasn't even on the radio. You know, I mean, that was the first and maybe only time. I can't see that I would have said the Exus, but I would have said the planet spit up, maybe.
Okay, but you did say Exodus, because that's what I wrote down.
Exus.
Exodus.
Not Exodus. X-I-S-T-S.
Oh.
Exit, like the word exist.
Oh,
they exist.
Okay. Oh,
we
okay.
Call them
I'll go double check that. Exit.
Yes, that saying them said the Exus.
Oh, plan for the exit return. Okay.
Exus, plural.
Exist.
They're aliens, and they exist. So saying them, call them the Exis. X.
Oh!
Capital X.
Okay.
Capital X, I-S-T-S. Here they are, the X's. The good thing.
Oh, that's it. Okay.
Yeah.
So then after that, Bob Box comes in and asks you, what do you do when your government has been taken over by foreigners and you know that their goal is to run it into the ground? They have started to take over the media and government. Do we write novels or send telegrams or leave the country? What do we do, Bob? And then you said, well, you do all three. And so leave the country is what you did. And I think that you said that many times to get out of Canada. And Mayall said that.
Yeah.
And you're the greatest thing that ever came out of Canada.
Yeah. Well, Connie, too.
Yes, of course. And then Bob Locke said a 007.
Wait. Okay. So I write a letter to the editor, write a novel, was it?
Write novels, send telegrams, or leave the country.
All three, not or, and.
You said all three.
So I would say, can't say I wrote any letters to the editor, but the show was a novel. But I didn't know if there'd be more chapters. But McLuhan used to say the great American novel that Norma Mailer and those people used to claim to be writing someday or have written was actually The Newspaper. That was the great American novel written by, well, any country, but in America especially. Americans were writing a collective art form, and it was the great American novel or fiction was The Newspaper. So I would probably have, if I got a chance, to come back and say anything more, I'd say that this radio show was a great American novel. It was an update of The Newspaper medium.
Definitely.
Okay, finished.
And then Bob Black says the 007 jet was being used for espionage purposes by the CIA. And then you
can. Do you remember
the
which
anti-Bob-
voice? I'm pretty sure. Hey, listen, I'm pretty sure Nelson, whatever one. I don't remember Bob Box, or Bob Locks and Bob Mox or something, or Bob Fox. But Nelson, if you began to notice his voice, he's the one who asked the letters. And then the 007, that might have been James Kidney.
Okay.
Voice.
Okay, they sounded very much the same.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't tell them apart.
So he's talking about the famous KEL-007 that went down end of August, September, early September 1983, and Larry Flint had taken over the LA Free Press, Los Angeles Free Press, and he put out a big ad all over the place, maybe in the LA Free Press. I'm not sure how widespread it was, but it seemed to be all over the place, saying, no, he questioned what the news was saying, that Russia knocked it out or something. And then Mae Brussels called Larry Flint to introduce herself and say, I agree with your ad, and here's some more details. So that's when he got infatuated with Mae Brussels and started Rebel magazine on her behalf. And Zappa told the story that he was talking to Larry Flint in his office around that time, and he came in and he saw the ad on some drawing board, whatever you call it, some layout, as Flint was preparing it. And he read it and he said to Larry, you got to correct this and that. So he actually adjusted the wording for the ad. So that sort of bonded Larry and Zappa, and Zappa was getting a photo spread prepared for the April 1984 Hustler issue. And that was in September. So Zappa was there to witness the Rebel and the parties and G. Gordon Liddy and Tim Leary and Dick Gregory and other CIA assholes partying at Larry Flint's from like the fall of 83. To the point that Mark Cooper, a lefty columnist, sort of like a Christopher Hitchens character, he lobbied to get May out as editor of the thing. He didn't like May Brussels. So May was forced to quit. And then it went into a further tragedy with Larry being arrested in Chicago while sitting wheelchair to wheelchair with Sherman Skolnick. And then that was the end of Hustler for a while. And Rebel magazine only got 8 issues, but I got all 8 issues. So that's all I'll say about that. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so after he brought up the 007 jet was being used for espionage purposes by the CIA, you come in and you're like, the anti-Bob forces.
Yeah, now that was quoting the Book of the Subgenius, probably.
Oh, okay. And that's not something McLuhan said? About.
No, you never said the anti-Bob forces.
Was the Bob Locks and Bob Box also into McLuhan? So they would know what you were talking about?
Nelson, yes.
Oh, okay.
Nelson was a student of McLuhan's at the University of Toronto in the early 70s. He's born in 52, so, 18, 19, 20, very early. He might have even met McLuhan when he was 16 because his father, being one of the top guys on the executive, the Toronto Star, famous Canadian authors of the time or journalists would come over to Nelson's house because they liked his father. So I think Nelson met Marshall as a kid at like 16, but he hung out with him as soon as he got going to university. And so Nelson was well-versed on McLuhan, at least absorbing it. When he met me in April 83, and we got together in May 83, so 10 years after he met McLuhan, say, or after he was involved with McLuhan, I'll tell you a couple of anecdotes. Nelson was walking on the street with McLuhan, and McLuhan pointed out the debris. What do you call that stuff on the sidewalk, the paper snap, forget the term. Anyways, the garbage. And he says, see all that, Nelson? Yeah. He says, see, it takes energy to clean up that stuff. And people don't have any energy today. And he was saying, probably had some more words that made the point that the electric environment takes people's energies away.
Oh.
Nobody had the energy to pick up the garbage. So he pointed out the electric effect there. Then another time they're walking along, and there was always all over Toronto these boxes with the Toronto Star. That was Nelson's father's newspaper. There were 4 other families that were on the executive. And so there'd be these boxes, where you put some coin in and open it and get a newspaper, get a copy for that day. So he's walking along with Nelson, and he pointed to the box. He knew Nelson's family history, and he said, you see that? Yeah. That's your long underwear. That's what he said. said the Toronto Star is Nelson's long underwear. So media art clothing, which was a major McLuhan theme, and Nelson winter, cold Toronto, and it was Nelson's long underwear, I guess. You know what I mean? Since they kind of hijacked and owned the thing. So those are two stories I remember. And then a third one, he was in the office, and McLuhan was, he called into a conference out in Winnipeg or someplace of these academics or some intellectuals, and they were doing a conference on McLuhan. So he says, what themes, so Nelson overheard this in the office. What themes are you playing with? They said, we're talking about your book, The Medium is the Massage, which came out in 67, a little paperback thing that McLuhan really had nothing to do with. Just people used quotes from him and imagery. So, what themes are you playing with? And the guy said, we're talking about The Medium is the Massage, you know, your book. And he says, that ain't a book. That's just a smattering of quotations. So he put down what they were doing. He said, that's not a book. So those are some stories. And then another time, the guy who wrote The Exorcist, Paddy Chayefsky, who actually wrote for McLuhan's Explorations magazine in the 50s, that movie came out in 73, and it was Paddy Chayefsky or the director, I guess Marshall was on talking on the phone and explaining that the Exorcist theme it should be about how media possess people, and everybody's possessed by a demon, the electric media. So Nelson heard him commenting on the movie The Exorcist in that manner. Okay, next.
Oh, okay. I'll come back to that later because I have questions about that. But okay, so.
No, you can go ahead. If it's about that, go ahead.
Oh, just about how the media was the exorcist. Possessing people. That is there a book? Which book did he write that he talks about that?
It would be in a magazine article.
Oh, okay.
Of the time in 73, 74. I don't know of too many places where it was repeated, but I read everything, so eventually I'd see something that was said at least once. Hmm. And he may have said it somewhere too, but I don't have that.
Okay, so moving on, they were shouting. Oh, this was maybe one of the Bobs said they were shouting the anti-Bob force. Oh no, they were shouting the anti-Bob forces had shut down the anti-Bob forces.
they would be Nelson and James would be the two Bobs would be the anti-Bob forces.
Okay, and what is the example?
So that was often talked about. That we always thought, well, are you Eddie Bob or Eddie Bob?
Okay, so if the anti-Bob forces are the government, aliens,
Adam Bond, anybody who's a pink.
Oh, okay.
Like I just posted the guy, Jerry Belanger, the kid, just starting to be a DJ. He was up at York University. He wasn't even a CKLN then. He was a fan of me, so when Nelson made the album, him and Dave Neufeld made the album, Jerry Belanger had just started a record distribution company called Dove, Death of Vinyl Company, D-O-V-E, maybe, or D-O-B. And so he distributed, but he took out ads in American papers with the subgenius Dove's head. So that led to staying... trying to sue us and anybody else, really pissed Stang off. So Jerry was fired for doing that. He was too young. He didn't understand or something. So then Nelson took over distribution and the advertising. And Nelson, so then you see the album is, maybe if more copies were made, would be under Time Again Productions, I think he called it. But it was under Dove, Death of Vinyl. So what was happening? Death of Vinyl. I guess the internet music, digital music, I guess. Yeah, digital music was happening in that point. And I always remember sitting in the car with Jerry one day, Jerry Belanger, B-E-L-A-N-G-E-R. This ridiculous music was on the car radio in the background. And it wasn't music. It was just fucking a drum beating.
Like techno
and,
music?
He said it was house music, I think.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I first heard the term. I said, what the fuck is that? It's just house music. And I was marveling that some kid who was pretty knowledgeable about music would be fucking listen to that shit as if it was entertainment. But it showed that the sensibilities of the young kids were quite removed from mine, you know. And then I immediately knew, well, this is the shape that the new global theater is putting kids into.
Well, David Byrne, in his book, How Music Works, he sort of goes into a point where it's like he appreciates house music and techno music when it's playing in the right arena, when you're actually all dancing together on a floor out of your mind on MDMA.
Right.
Pardon me, but he doesn't quite understand why anyone would want to listen to it in their car or on their headphones or out of the context or right. And he's kind of an autist. He's also a subgenius, mind you. But so
yes,
he, like, he's kind of the same mindset as you have.
Yeah, and he Zappa used to say that the popularity of music, the styles. I think he first said it during the early 70s during Quaaludes and heavy metal. He said the drug determined the music.
Huh.
If people were into certain kind of drugs, they would go for a certain kind of music, and that's why that music would take over. So he agrees with David Byrne. Now, the other thing about David Byrne, in 1985 or so, did you ever see it? He did a movie called True Story.
True Story.
Singular. Yeah, plural. And in it, there's a guy in a white suit like Tom Wolfe used to wear.
That's David Byrne. He was the guy driving around, right?
No, he was it was an excerpt out of the movie kind of thing. It's maybe like 8 minutes. And this white suited character did a Bob Marshall rant. It was all he had, and he had pictures of the Rockefellers and everything. It was a typical top-down Bob Marshall rant, and I was amazed that he did that because...
Oh, he's yelling at the Trilateral Commission, and yeah, they had a whole song about conspiracy theories, yeah, and there was like this pastor, this reverend dude screaming about stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that, and in that sense, it was a takeoff on the Church of Genius, maybe. But Bob Marshall didn't wear a white suit, but we'd all seen Tom Wolfe in Toronto recently, and he always wore this white suit. So I thought, well, I said, you know, I didn't know they were around a bit. I knew both of them a bit, but I thought that was pretty cool that David Byrne put that in a movie, that kind of stuff. I don't think that ever been done before so blatantly with, you know, what do you call that? A point? What was the lectures called when the people would first show slides?
Overhead.
Oh, projector.
Overhead projector,
begins with
yeah.
P. Begins with P.
You're talking about the computer software that got popular for that. It's called PowerPoint, but it was overhead projector slides before that. You know,
So I think he did the PowerPoint before there was PowerPoint. I'm not sure. That's the way it came across. Pretty close. timing and when did PowerPoint happen? But anyways, I saw the movie. What?
Greg used to do overhead animations and graphics for people's presentations by hand. In animation and stuff, he's talked about that stuff before, right? It was a business to create slide projections for people before computer software.
Okay, so I was impressed with David Byrne because he did that. I mean, I wasn't on the radio; Bob Marshall was, but I wondered if he'd heard of Bob Marshall's thing because it was pretty unique how Bob Marshall presented all these different conspiracies, not from one point of view, just a whole different schools of thought. That's what was unique about. We were the first to present a mosaic of top-down information, we would call it. Mm. And then that's what David Byrne did in that movie, True Story. So if anybody wants to see an interesting movie, check that out. I don't remember what else was in it, but it was worth seeing, whatever happened.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Yeah, John Candy, True Stories.
Oh.
Plural.
It's a whole bunch of short vignettes of people in this town, slice of life, and they're all weirdo characters. Yeah, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of like a David Lynch movie, actually, a little bit, in its own way.
Nice.
Maybe not weird enough, maybe in its discontinuity and stuff, but
Yeah.
It wasn't eccentrically weird like Lynch. It somehow weird does a bit differently. But it
yeah,
was
he wasn't exploring anyone's Jungian shadow, but I mean, the characters were oddball as fuck, right? And huge exaggerations. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. Go ahead, next point. So what we're doing, Clinton, if you didn't hear the beginning, is we're listening to the first time I was on the radio, October 1st, 84. Did you hear that introduction?
Oh, cool. Okay, no, it's not. And also, my lunch break is over. But I'll call back in around 9:30 or so.
Okay, and you can catch this in the archive. So I
sure.
didn't know if I'd be on the radio very long, ever again. So I put every fucking idea I knew, a lot of it in 25 minutes. So we're... Kate went through and listened to it, so I asked her to inventory it, just show you stuff that I repeated once I was on the radio 1,000 times. So this is a clue to Bob's repertoire, so to speak. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Clinton. Okay, so carry on.
Okay, you said Kate. Media is the only way anybody is going to know anything. You guys got the finger on the little button. Oh, wait. Okay, maybe that was Bob, other Bobs.
Yeah, that's not the kind of thing I would say, that
no.
Media is the only way we'd know anything.
I think,
that's too content.
Oh, yeah, okay. I think that's when he was talking about the government. I might have wrote that again somewhere else. Okay, so then Bob Locke was asking you, in the age of gigantic pictorial illusionism and journalistic exaggeration of consuming... the truth in
concealment, journalist exaggeration of concealment.
Okay. Oh, it's just concealment. I'm glad you know that because I couldn't really hear sometimes because of the audio. So
yeah, now what that is, that's from an article by McLuhan in the early 50s talking about Wyndham Lewis. And so Nelson took that same article, and that's in 84, so... 8 years later, in 92, he put out the Bosman Ecology album, and he has a little booklet, and he writes a little foreword to the album. He literally quotes that from the article.
Oh, okay.
He liked that article, the journalistic exaggeration of concealment.
Yeah, because
so
the way he said
content.
That. Yeah, when he said that, I was like, wow, I love the way he said that. But now I know he got that from McLuhan.
Who
in the age of gigantic.
He got
Lewis.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Okay.
A lift from Lewis. But the point is that Marshall wrote essays on James Joyce, and he compared James Joyce with the American attempt to simulate Joyce in Ulysses, John Dos Passos. And he said Passos was more of a journalistic author, and the journalist rides on paranoia, tries to scare the population, whereas the artist doesn't do that. The artist is not there to scare you. The artist is giving you some interesting underground pattern or something. I mean, serious artists. So Marshall didn't like, he says that Joyce didn't like the typical sensationalistic journalistic novelist. He was countering that. That's
okay.
An important point.
And the gigantic... gigantic pictorial illusionism is what, like TV or what? What is that?
No, photography.
Oh, okay.
This is all after the telegraph.
Oh, okay. So then after he said that about the...
Oh, I'll just say this. See, the photograph, I think, was invented in 1837 or so. Telegraph was around the same time. So the telegraph and the photograph come in together, and I think historians of media, the postmodern guys, maybe Baudrillard, would point out that that was the beginning of virtual reality, when you had the telegraph and the photograph.
Mm.
So virtual reality didn't start in 1991. It started in the 1850s,
1870s.
No longer
alpha. Really? Oh, wow. Way back then.
Yeah.
Because many people think that that's a new invention.
Yeah. Well, it was. It's better, technically. It just got better and better. But historically, if you're going to use that term, you should know that regular academic scholars consider that began with photography, which showed you reality.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't a painting. It was a photograph of all kinds of things. So that was a new level of stimulation.
Right.
So that's why art played down visual precision, played down narrative and portraiture and became abstract, played with paint and color itself to counter the literalness of the photograph. So that leads to impressionism, fauvism, surrealism, cubism, all that stuff. Was the result was the artist instinctively, I don't know how consciously, saying, I'm not going to make my art try to keep up with the photograph.
Mm. Right. Okay, so then after he said that, then you can see how this is related. But then he said, certainly the truth in conversation has disappeared everywhere.
Yeah, that's nowhere, from that article.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Nowhere we go do we run into any truth in conversation. The pictorial illusion is so rampant and massive and environmental that most people disappeared everywhere except Club 22 Bob.
Yeah, now that Marshall didn't write that. Now Nelson is adding his spin.
Yeah.
And he probably wrote that, added that in the booklet preface of Bob's Ecology in 92. And he said Bob was the only guy who conversed around truth conversationally. You know what I mean?
Mm,
the only
right.
performance. Now, James and Nelson are one of the earliest members of Club 22. I knew about the number 22, and so I'm hanging out with them from 83, middle of 83 on. I remember Tony Senta, he was a real expert on the JFK assassination, and he had a long slideshow go many hours, and James and I and Nelson went to it. Nelson knew him well, so we met Tony, but over the next few years, Tony would go on cruises, you know, bourgeois cruises, and people would want to see his Kennedy show, or the owners of the cruise who presented the vacation would thought Tony's stuff was interesting for a cruise. So he became quite well known out of Toronto. But he just kept counting the blades of grass, Mae Brussel would say, the blades of grass in Dealey Plaza on the grassy knoll. He wasn't an activist. He just was an archivist. He kept up on all the books and stuff, but he's just a working class guy who had a job, but he liked to do that stuff as a hobby. So we used to try to get him to come on the show, but he wouldn't do it. He also, I think he was still nervous, maybe, you know, appropriately. He was nervous about getting hurt for doing it because his slideshows were quite a revelation for the details that people didn't have real access to yet. They might read one book by Mark Lane or somebody, but there were many books out by 20 years later in the 80s, and Tony had it all laid out. So I wonder if he's still alive. So Tony, we'll nod to Tony Senta, C-E-N-T-A, if you want to look him up.
Okay.
Okay, next.
So, but when he said that most people disappeared everywhere except Club 22, we can say that now and say most people disappeared except for Iandam. And Dobbstown.
Right. Well, this is what Puzzling Shadow, I think it was him. Someone recently posted this point. Oh, no, I got an email from somebody. Jesse Ward, I don't know who he is, asked me to explain how Bob, reappeared. And that came out in 90. That came out in 95. But I've been saying in the 80s that everybody disappeared, just visually. You couldn't see anybody if they were on electric sound media. And then the human scale, the chemical body had been wiped out. So Nelson knew that. He'd heard that from me. So he's quoting me. he didn't say the point that we were the first to reappear. He didn't say those words, I don't think, in there, but that's how you finish it. He said, yeah, everything's disappeared, and Bob has reappeared. And that was the prophecy at the end of Up the Gore Christianity, where I said, you hang out with Bob and Connie, you'll reappear, and you'll take the D-cell water, and it'll make you live forever. So that anticipated I end up with the I-cell and the living water. And everything else I was about, like, staying in the body and not dying is kind of reappearing and not going to the normal route of disappearing physically.
Oh, yeah. Most people who disappear get possessed by the tech body.
Well, just electric media, beginning with the telegraph. Whole populations are wiped out. And chemical bodies still walk around, apparently, but they don't have any real effect on the makeup of daily reality. So the effect of chemical bodies was gone. That was one meaning of disappearing. And then everybody died, but nothing new about that. So as I say these ideas, everybody, regular listeners, should recognize I've said these ideas 100 times.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
But this was all said, you know, at one moment. And
really fast.
A couple of actor friends listening. And after they called up James, said, wow, that was incredible. Imagine if radio was like that all the time. So we stunned, or I stunned people with the ideas. And Nelson and James, they stunned people in reciprocating what I was saying. And there's a point about James we'll mention. If you don't, we'll mention it coming up, but I won't say it yet. So the next idea.
Okay, so then you brought up Club 22 and the 7 holy offices.
Seven. Now we were I didn't finish that. Jerry Belanger, before the album came out in 92, before he was advertising it and then PR for it and then got fired, he had a zine, but it was a big square, like the size of a big magazine. But it was just cheap paper and that, and he called it hype. And one day he asked me to create something. So I made a chart of the trivium and the quadrivium, plus a couple of extra, and totaling 10 holy offices. There's 3 parts of the trivium, 4 parts of the quadrivium. So there's 7. And then you see Cosmic Awareness, the Occult, and Garrett Dean, the Personal Mentor, and Club 22 added to those 7. So ALP has a lot of stuff that I handed out at the station back then. And so I used to hand out that copies of that cheap little thing. So it might have been a zine, but it was called Hype. And it's a good chart, and ALP just posted it, so you can see it on I and Bob. It's the cover, the first image you see before I think you go to addendum. And what's interesting is I showed the pink version of the holy offices. So, you know, rhetoric is Marshall McLuhan. The counter to that is, I don't remember. I'll have to look at that. What the hell was it? See, this is when I get talking. I lose myself in my own talk and imagery. So I end up forgetting things. So look up rhetoric now. Okay, I'm going to try to see if I can eventually remember it. So
okay.
The logic, the subgenius is LaRouche, and the pink is Henry Kissinger. That's dialectics logic. Then in grammar, the subgenius is Herbert W. Armstrong, and the pink is Jerry Falwell. So this is laid out on the image in Hype magazine. Then in music, Frank Zappa is the subgenius, John Lennon is the pink. In geometry, Finnegan's Wake is the holy office, and any novelist is the pink version of geometry. Arithmetic is May Brussel, and the pink version of May Brussel, or of arithmetic, is Mark Lane, who wrote pretty well the first exposure of the Warren Commission. I think the book came out in about 67. That book was written in the upper floor of a building down in Soho. And the owner was Murray and Cecile Gross, G-R-O-S-S. And they lived there. They were lawyers. She worked for the United Nations. He was in the FBI. And he's the one who exposed the mafia's dealings in securities. And then had to worry for 2 years whenever he turned his car on in the morning going to work, whether it would blow up or not. He eventually quit the FBI, being a lawyer. And he worked for the major DA in New York. So Murray knew a lot about, you know, the legal world in New York. But I met Murray and Cecile because they were members of the Finney's Wake group that I found in the fall of 93, when we just shortly after I got to New York City with Carol doing Mir. And then Nick Fagnoli, he was the leader of it, and he was an academic. And one day I started quoting Eric McLuhan, another story I've told. And he says, "Eric McLuhan, you know him?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Wow, I was at the University of Dallas, and then there's a sub college within that. I forget what it was called." And I said, "I was in, you know, doing my PhD or graduate work with some professor, and Eric was there. Boy, I hated that guy. I hated his stuff." So the head of the Finney's Wake guy was Eric McLuhan. Now, he didn't hate me, but that was at first synchrony in a way. But Nick he put out a couple of good encyclopedic books on James Joyce over the next years, and he was working on it. So he was too busy doing that, so he quit after a year or so, and he didn't run the thing anymore. Occasionally he'd drop in. So Murray had become friends of Nick, and he probably had the best mind, a lawyer kind of mind. So he was the best researcher of the nobodies and rookies in the Finney's Wake. So he took over the group. He was appointed by Nick. So we became good friends. And why am I telling you this? So
holy offices, seven holy offices.
Is yeah, where it started. What? Arithmetic. Oh, Mark Lane. Well, when we got into the Kennedy, talking about the Kennedy assassination, he said Mark Lane wrote that book, Rush to Judgment, you know, an archetypal JFK research book, in his home in the upper floor. And we would have our Finney's Wake meetings at the famous Gotham bookstore, bookshop, bookmart, or Gotham something, run by a lady since the 1920s. So she was a legend in New York City, very hip, knowledgeable bookstore, and T.S. Eliot would come there and visit her. And he organized the James Joyce Society of New York with this lady. Can't remember her name right now. So she gave us the second floor of the Gotham Bookmart, and we'd be there once every 2 weeks or so doing our group. And that was the general group. But then those who wanted to do extra research would meet, and there had to be a certain level of familiarity with the Wake. They would meet in the upper room in Murray's house, once a month at least. I don't think we did two every 2 weeks, because we were doing the other more populist meeting every 2 weeks. Anyway, so once a month we meet in Murray's. So that went on for many, many years. It's still going on. Murray died a couple of years ago. But anyways, we analyzed Finney's Wake, and I was probably back then the only guy saying that Finney's Wake anticipated the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission was such a 26 volumes, such a jabble, a fucked up mosaic of nonsense and fiction and everything, and some facts thrown in, that it really was like reading Finney's Wake, but it was in English. So I used to talk about Finney's Wake is actually anticipates and is like a Warren Commission on the history of humanity and history of media and everything. So I would talk about that. And nobody else would say that. But there, the first book was written in the room that I talked about it in. That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So Murray's room was where the thinking of JFK and exposing the stupid elite's version of what happened, the lone nut theory, that all those thoughts are still in that room, and I was able to ride on them. And I was always looking for the top-down conspiracy stuff, besides the McLuhan media bottom-up stuff, in Finney's Wake, and there's a lot of it there. And I'm now reading, I decided not to reread Ulysses, but to read the annotations of Ulysses, which is 650 pages. And most people would not read this boring accounting and explaining every word and everything that young people wouldn't know about anymore, or anybody would know. But I'm seeing a lot of stuff. It's really fun reading it because I can project in the top-down stuff Joyce has in there. It's really unfolding. It's almost a better way to read Ulysses because the author, Don Gifford, and his assistant are spelling out all the encyclopedic stuff that Joyce was referring to, which you would miss when you read Ulysses. You'd be thrown by the discontinuous dialogue, and most people can't read Ulysses, let alone Finney's Wake. So this is a way to get the information of in Ulysses. And what was I saying? So Mark Lane, Ulysses. Oh, okay. So I'm reading the notes, and I do about 10 pages a day, and it's pretty neat. So it takes a couple of months, 60 days. So you get 600 pages, so maybe 70 days. But I recommend it. It's really informative. A lot about history of the world, history of religions, history of Ireland, a lot of music songs, vaudeville songs, theater songs of the 19th century, names of actors and actresses of that period who were American or others who would come and play in Dublin. So maybe that's all I'm just saying. That's what I'm reading now. Instead of reading Ulysses, I'm reading I want to get the details, the encyclopedic information in the book, and it's paying off. So
does it come with the book?
That. Oh, yeah. No, you have to buy a big book. Now, I re-met Dave Wally, the man who wrote the first biography of Frank Zappa in 1972-73. I met him in New York, and then he invited Caroline up to his family in Williamstown, I think it's called. It has a famous liberal college, a lot of good professors, and in the old 60s mode of not the counterculture, but there's a famous liberal arts college. It's Williams College is, maybe not Williamstown, but Williams College is a famous one. And so he lives in the town. And so while I was there on that weekend, he said, I want you to come visit the guy. So a friend of his. So he went, and this guy lived in a trailer. I guess he didn't have that much money. But he was a professor and a Joyce scholar. I didn't know anything about him. And we had a conversation, and I was talking about McLuhan, and I don't remember much enthusiasm about what I was saying. So I listened to him, but after only talking for about half an hour, and then for some reason David decided that was it, and we left. I would have stayed longer. Well, that turned out to be Don Gifford. I didn't realize until years later when I got the annotation. Well, I had the annotations, but I hadn't read it. I hadn't noticed the author or something. And suddenly he said, wow, Don Gifford, that's the name of the guy that Dave Wally introduced me to. And we did talk about Joyce. He had something to do with Joyce. But I didn't know that he had done the annotations. That's one of my major mistakes. I really screwed up there. If I had known who that was and I had looked into the annotation, which I knew a little bit about, I wouldn't have brought up McLuhan. I would have interviewed him about what he did. So there, I occasionally think about that. I blew it with him. I didn't know, it just wasn't in my mind when we went there. And I didn't associate Joyce with David Wally, even though he's a literate graduate of Yale University and a critic of culture. And, official critic, that was his field. And he had a great column in the East Village Other and knew Dean Latimer and Walter Bowert. He and Dave Wally, in some ways he was I don't know if a nerd or straight or something, a bit maybe pompous, but he and Dean Latimer don't get along, didn't get along. And if Chad has read, remembers, he posted all the Dean Latimer columns on I and Bob. There is one column where Dave Wally comes in, and Dean Latimer, who had no money and was crashing at the East Village of their office, he was sleeping there, and Dave Wally sprayed something all over him and then left. So this outraged Dean Latimer. So he wrote a column about it. And if you remember, Chad, we could bring it up somewhere if we don't have it immediately. And, you know, putting down Dave Wally and how he didn't like Dave Wally. And then I don't think Wally wrote much after that. He kind of left the East Village other. That was maybe in 71. At the time the book came out in 72, he had a falling out with Zappa. I went to New York in November 71 to see 200 Motels, the premier there. And I stayed at Dave Wally's, who I'd met at the East Village other office a few months before. Don't think I met him in 70, but I met him in 71 in May, June. And so we became friends. And so I'm staying with him, and I'm listening to him complain about Frank is pissed off at him. Dave doesn't understand why he's hurt. And so but while I was at his home, his apartment on like 7th Street, I read the manuscript to 200 Motels. I read his manuscript of the biography. I don't know how much I read, but it was good. And so Wally never recovered his friendship with Zappa. And Zappa would put down Wally in interviews. So I think, I wouldn't say this to Dave Wally at the time, but the flaw in his personality, his pomposity or something, Zappa took as Dave was too needy, wanted, you know, to be a student of Zappa too much, psychologically depended on it or something. And Zappa wouldn't tolerate that kind of stuff. So that's maybe how Wally was perceived, but Wally wasn't that way, obviously. He might have been different. I didn't see the Wally with Zappa. But when Nigel Lennon's book came out, Zappa, one of Zappa's early mistresses, it came out in 95 or so, it reminded Wally of something. So he went back and got out his cassette recordings of interviews of Zappa he did for the book. And in one of them, he hears a young lady come into the basement at Zappa's home, the basement studio, and starts talking to Frank, and maybe her name is said, but Wally realizes that's Nigel Lennon in 71, and that's when she was there, and she writes about that year in her book, and she even performs with the Mothers a couple of gigs. She was a good guitarist, and she was only 18 or something. And so Wally called up, got in touch with Nigel Lennon and said, I have a recording with you in the basement. I met you. He had long forgotten it. But now the book, a very good book called Being Frank, came out. And so they became very good friends. And they collaborated on different stuff. I don't think it ever got published. But I heard a lot about Wally and Nigel from both of them. And in my long interview with Nigel Lennon, that's on bobonzappa.com or YouTube. I don't know if you remember, Chad. Maybe we talk about Dave Wally, Nigel and I think. If we didn't on the recording part, we might have done it on the unrecording. And we would talk about the problem David had with Zappa. Nigel certainly understood what she was up against. She didn't break down as much as Wally, but she had a lot of problems with Frank, emotional ups and downs. But so Wally, Nigel Lennon. So the Zappa, the anti-Zappa crew in New York, people into Ginsberg and that. Oh, yeah, Ginsberg, there it is. Ginsberg is the antidote to McLuhan, or the pink version of rhetoric, Allen Ginsberg. And McLuhan had a big photo of Ginsberg in his office that the New York Times uses a lot. They do an article on McLuhan. They'll show McLuhan laid out in his couch or lounge, chaise, lounge, whatever you call them, with this big, huge photograph of Ginsberg hanging over him. So that was the Ed environment. And I recently emphasized that Hugh Hefner was pretty clever. He has McLuhan in Playboy in March 69, a long interview. And then the next month is Ginsberg, April 69, a long interview. And you couldn't get more opposites. McLuhan is talking technically, actually, people didn't realize it, scientifically. He's not, and Ginsberg's on there telling everybody to fuck in the streets and all this hedonistic stuff or hippie stuff that Ginsberg was famous for. The exact, the stuff that Marshall wouldn't quote before or emphasize. He would discuss that Ginsberg is a knee-jerk reflex to the global, reflex action of the global theater. So Ginsberg is the pig. And Walter Bauer tells a story that Ginsberg visited McLuhan once, and he came back and he told Walter, Marshall and McLuhan is homophobic, because he went to hug Marshall and Marshall wouldn't really accept the hug. Only I would know this almost. There was this conflict between Ginsberg and McLuhan, you know? So that's appropriate. It's all very appropriate. Then there was the conflict between Zappa and Lennon. Lennon ripped off Frank. Let's see. Herbert Armstrong, he was never political in his Christian fundamentalism. Jerry Falwell was political. Herbert Armstrong didn't agree with that. And Herbert was maybe a more interesting Bible scholar. He probably did more research than whatever Falwell claimed to be doing, even though Falwell had something called Liberty University or something. And definitely LaRouche and Kissinger were enemies. And commented on each other. And Kissinger busted and put LaRouche in jail. So those charts, what I have there is very real. And then you have Mae Brussel versus Mark Lane. She criticized Mark Lane and every other JFK researcher expert for not going all the way and not emphasizing the Nazi stuff and not being out there trying to get a court action going. Let's put these guys in court and put them in jail. They're more authors, and they would go on and write other books about other things. And Mark Lane, I think, became a senator, or he was a senator at some point, or he became one. Mark Lane, senator. So there's May, and then you got Beter versus Sidney Omar, and not many people, unless they're older, know he was one of the main astrology columnists in newspapers, you know, all over the world. He was a major explainer of astrology, but I would make that a subplot of astronomy. And Beter was a better astronomer than Sidney Omar, because he pointed out the changes happening in the sky, which were the particle beam bases on the moon. He added a new technological media, technological nature to what the astronomers would see, or astrologers. So that's an important dialectic. And of course, cosmic awareness is a Dave Worster is a very important metaphysician in the occult sphere. And you juxtapose him with Shirley MacLaine, who popularized the New Age in the 80s. Shirley MacLaine in the 90s or 2000s wrote many books, but one book she wrote, she built it around Carolyn. Talks about Carolyn's medicine and how she follows Carolyn's stuff. I don't know if Death by Modern Medicine was out by then. That's 2005. No, I sometimes associate talking about it in 2013 up in White Rock, where Michael Blake Reed lived right on the border of Washington State and Vancouver, or British Columbia. And we were talking about that book, where someone brought it up. Maybe Allison or somebody told us that she looked at the book and saw it. I remember Carolyn going and looking at it or something and seeing the stuff about her. That surprised her. But I just suppose, you know, there's a battle over Connie between Cosmic Awareness, who said Carolyn was unique because she was on the only one in Akasha, and then Shirley MacLaine did her Kmart or McDonald's version of Akasha and her stuff. So that's a good polarity there. That's the occult. And then in personal mentors, I have Garrett Dean. He was my personal mentor. But I don't have anything opposite him, I don't think, on the chart. Let's just check that. What would I put? Well, in a way, McLuhan, Zappa, all the other Holy Offices are mentors of me, but they weren't completely personal relationships like Gary, who lived in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, spent a lot of time with them. So I'll just look up the picture, 10 Holy Offices. You see it under, as soon as you go to the site. Oh, I have this Bob Dobbs head as the ultimate. Yeah, it's in the same position. Up top is Garrett, and beside Garrett it says, "Who's Forgotten Furry Lint?" And it doesn't say what his category is, but down below, at the bottom, in the same, you know, mirrored position, picture of Sang's Dobbs head, which is based on my father, it says, "Icon of Bizarre Dallas Cult of Materialism." So, yeah, I put Garrett, to me, Garrett was the ranter J.R. Bob Dobbs. He was the real deal.
Hmm.
And had a life like the way J.R. Bob Dobbs is talked about. Garrett had a big problem, investigated by the FBI. They set him up and claimed he murdered his roommate. Now, Garrett, he was bisexual, but mainly lived a gay life. But what a talker. And we've got recordings of him. And he was an amazing guy. So I positioned him opposite the Church of the Subgenius. And then you have Club 22. So that is the club. And I didn't know at that time there was a Club 22 in Toronto. It was a diner room or a bar room in the Windsor Hotel. And Chad was living in Windsor at the time. So
it was an actual club.
Chad could put him, what?
It was an actual club. Like, I thought Club 22 was kind of just something.
Well,
new.
I didn't know it. Club 22 was just my friends, mm-hmm. my lawyer, Deb Aaron, Ian Arlett, my bodyguard, Shannon and Paul, our twin foster kids, Bob Marshall. I didn't have many other friends. So maybe Barry Nevitt. Oh, yeah, Nelson Thal. So, you know, there weren't that many people. Certainly not De Kirchhoff, not Eric McLuhan. Marge Stewart would have been part of it, and George Thompson later. So anybody that would give some of their time to me and take an interest in the top-down, bottom-up stuff I presented on the radio and in person, they and contributed things, they would be members of Club 22. So it was... an echo of, there was a lot of people who had clubs, in pop culture. In New York, I don't know, they just had this slang stuff, or club something. There's all kinds of that in New York, I remember, in the underground. So I was playing off that. So I wouldn't, what is the opposite of that, the pink version? Don't know what I say in the chart. I don't know. So there's all that. Look at that chart. It's really good. And so back. Okay, what's next?
Okay. So then you brought up the 7 holy offices. And then you said the major points made by the holy offices. The first thing you said was there's no music except for Frank Zappa. Which is true. And then... Marsh McLuhan, the greatest international Canadian ever to have lived.
Yeah.
And then the religious point, the grammarian is with Hubert Armstrong. Pointed
Herbert
out,
W. Armstrong. Hubert
Armstrong.
W. Armstrong.
Pointed
Not
out
Hubert,
that,
Herbert.
Herbert.
Same name as
yes.
McLuhan.
Oh, okay. Herbert W. Armstrong pointed out that we are Israel, not the land known as Judah in the Bible, but not knowing.
Yeah, there was Israel and Judah.
Yeah.
There was Israel and Judah. And so many people think Israel was Judah and Judah was Israel. No, they're two separate places set up by the son. Israel comes from Jacob, who got the name Israel. Maybe his name was Isaac, the father of the 12 sons. His name was Isaac or Jacob, and then they changed his name to Israel. And there were a bunch of people. One of the sons, I think Reuben, was a bit alienated from the other brothers. So he removed himself, and he lived on the edge of Israel or outside the border, and that was Judea, J-U-D-E-A. Now, I learned something I didn't know reading Don Gifford's annotations. You have Homer doing the Iliad and the Odyssey and what, something else. Then there's the guy, H.E. somebody, forget his name. He does something. But then there's Aeneas, and he wrote the Aeneid, which is like the adventures of Odysseus, or Odysseus in Homer. Odysseus coming back from the Battle of Troy. Well, Virgil wrote the Aeneid, you know, 800 years later, so to speak, and I didn't know that he was considered the father of Rome, of the Romans. So you have the Greek Homeric epic on Odysseus, the Odyssey, I guess. I don't think Odysseus is a founder of the Greeks, but Aeneas, no. I don't know why, how it could be in, well, maybe Rome was done in around 5, whatever. Somehow there's a slight mention of Aeneas in Greek culture, Greek writings. Yeah, maybe it's not in Homer. But anyways, he's mentioned very slightly. And that's because he wasn't a Greek. He started Rome. And I've never heard that said. I didn't know that. And the Aeneid is about the travels of Aeneas, and he goes into Hades and goes down into the underworld and talks to dead spirits like Odysseus does. And so that's interesting. Anybody here knew that? Did you know that Aeneas was the founder of Rome, and the Greeks had a whole different world that Aeneas wasn't part of? No, Virgil wrote about Aeneas, but, you know, Aeneas wasn't part of the Greek history. Anybody knew that? I guess
no, I didn't. Did.
Oh, everybody's fucking muted. Sorry. We'll ask that later. Remember, let's get back to that.
Okay.
Take a poll on that. So there was something I just learned, I think, yesterday, reading the annotations. I knew about Virgil and Aeneid, but I didn't know what it was, much about it. But he's the father of Rome, Romans.
The founder or the father?
The father.
Father.
And, you know, the start of the race or whatever they are. And like Abraham is the father of Jews. And so you have, there were three sons. Don't remember. I think Jacob or Isaac is one of them. There's two other guys. So, and so I was looking at a map, and it showed, you know, Israel above, Judea below, and then to the right, attached to Israel and Judea, is Moab. Moab is really important. That seems to be where Jordan is today, maybe even Syria. And the, remember Moses, he's big deal up there with the Pharaoh in Egypt, but he kills an Egyptian soldier or something, so he has to leave, and he goes lives in Moab for 40 years, and he marries Roxy in that culture. So, well, according to Ion, anyways, Zephyr or something is the name that Roxy, Moses' wife, second, third wife or something. So the, anyways, it was neat. I never knew where Moab was juxtaposed to the others. So that's a side thing that I learned yesterday. Okay, next.
Oh, yeah, and another thing you you said about Israel is, who's Israel? We are.
Oh, yeah, about Herbert Armstrong. He said the 10 lost tribes didn't disappear. They went and became, they founded different parts of Europe, like the Danish are the tribe of Dan. And Manasseh and Ephraim, those two tribes, one is England and one is America. One comes out of the English one. And the secret to understanding the Bible is that it's describing the new Israel, which is America, or Ephraim and Manasseh together. So this whole Anglo thing. I guess that's why the queen and royalty liked Herbert. You know, he made that important. And I guess the stone of scone that a lot of British monarchs are crowned on is part of that history. I think Joseph, the father of Jesus, and maybe Mary, they go to England in that history that Herbert cites. This Herbert Armstrong, he purifies and completes the whole dogma, but there was something in the 19th century in England called British Israelites or British identity, and they're the ones that came up with Israel is Britain, so to speak. The 10 lost tribes, one of them is England. And that's why the British oligarchy definitely wanted to get Israel going for political reasons, military reasons, but also culturally. They identified, they wanted to make a home for what Britain was. I don't know how extreme they were about that, but they definitely had a thing called British Israel. They were called British Israelites. And Herbert came out of that tradition, but then he added new aspects to it and made it pretty perfect as a system. And this guy, Bo Polny, P-O-L-N-Y, who predicted, is a TikToker or somebody found this, and he predicted events of this past week and the historical role of Pentecost, and God always shows up on different significant Pentecost to do something. The guy predicted that something had to happen this past week, fulfilling biblical end time stuff. So he didn't know what it would be, but it wouldn't be good. So what happened was, people were looking for war, those that knew this Christian fundamentalist idea. They were looking for some kind of war to break out this past week. But J.W. texted Carol and said he knew about this prophecy. He knew it from his own understanding. And he says, yes, some of the Christians understand numbers and can work that out, but they steal your pocketbook. So J.W. separates himself. But I got a text from him today. He says, wow, a month in the bunker. Passover is over. I probably can talk to you in the next couple of days. The phone line will be open. So that's J.W. talking about Passover. So I need to go into more details about how much he's relying on that because, well, nothing happened, no war. And he said, no, the aliens that were doing this, the Pentagon aliens, they switched to hurricanes and tornadoes. They, for some reason, decided not to have a military conflict, but to wipe out people with 83 tornadoes. So Bo Polnoy, it'll be interesting to see if he says, yeah, the prediction came true, because he was really good over the past couple of months. He was naming April 14th, April 19th, and stuff that he predicted happened on those days. Not precisely, but heavy stuff between Israel and Iran happened on April 14th and April 19th. And he says Pentecost is coming up in May 18th or 19th. So Phil popularizes this stuff. Phil, if he's on there, he was on earlier, he might say something about this. Yeah, Phil might have posted, Phil probably posted that thing on my Facebook page. That's where I first saw it. So that's what's unique about Herbert Armstrong is that he, and now Ion goes into that meme and clarifies it and adds more details that blow Herbert's mind because America came from the original continent that fragmented into and dropped down onto the earth, the flat earth, and you got seven continents. It came from, what's the word on the Jewish, the hat on the Jewish head, call that original continent? Can't remember right now. But America is the most connected to the original continent of the singular continent, of the seven geographical regions or continents. And Ayn says that America was there before Europe, and Americans went to Europe. And so when Europe then responded and went back, they're going to see America, not because they think there's something there, or they don't even know that. They're going to China. But it turns out they knew something was there. They'd been initiated by the Americans, and we're going back there to live there. So it's all backwards. So when you read the first, so then I was looking at the first page of Finnegan's Wake, page 3, and it's about, in his jumble of language, it's about people going to Europe or returning to America and all this. And Ayn says that there's a whole level of Finnegan's Wake that comes from non-physical that Joyce wasn't aware of. And Ayn also says that the aliens in the 30s or 20s dictated Finnegan's Wake to Joyce. So we got to do more on that, talking to Ayn. And but the Ayonic knowledge that, you know, transatlantic culture comes from America rather than Europe, and there it is in Finnegan's Wake, that could be something channeled by the Evergreens, not the Evergreens, the that the aliens put in Joyce's head, the real history. So there's room to really start doing Finnegan's Wake on a bigger outline level, like you have on page 3, the first page. We're getting the details with Ayn putting the pages of Finnegan's Wake in the proper order. But so I was looking at the themes in on page 3, and it ends with Noah, and then there's the fall or the thunder. And that's exactly what happened, is the according to Ayn, Noah, under Ophanel's instructions, he was warned about a flood that was going to wipe out the interaction between angels and the daughters of men. There's too much copulation going on between angels and humans, and Ophanel didn't like this. So he removed the angels from the earth with the flood. So it's interesting, the that's, you have River Run, that one sentence about at the beginning of Finnegan's Wake. Then the second paragraph is my outline, 14 themes and characters. The last one, before you get to paragraph 3, which has the first thunder, is Noah. And you see Noah is on the aquifer. He sees the horizon, the new world on the horizon. But in there is the arc light. So you have the historical chemical body role of Noah bringing in a new world, which then, you know, Abraham in the new world after the flood starts the tribe of Israel, or the tribes of Israel. So Noah is a transition point, and technologically, the arc light, which was city lighting in London in the 19th century, that was one of the first applications of electricity. That's a big moment. That's a big fall for reality. The guff is open. So Ionic history might have an interesting, a detailed explanation of the events in page 3 of the Ulysses from of Finnegan's Wake from an Ionic perspective. And non-physical. Okay, so next.
Okay, then you bring up astronomy, and that Dr. Beter made a revelation of the Battle of the Harvest Moon on September 27th, 1977. Ever since then, the Russians conquered space.
Yeah, that is, I was talking about Beter and that meaning. He showed you new things going on in space. He added to the establishment astronomer view. I expressed that. So there it is. I'm saying that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Next.
And then you said Reagan has been a clone. The President Pope is a clone for secret Russian groups that the Russians are exposing.
That's Dr. Beter information.
Okay. And then you go on to say that the only strategy we have now.
Sure. Hey, they're not. If I say clone, that's technically a mistake. You're supposed to say organic robotoids. Was adamant about they weren't clones. They were something called organic robotoids.
Oh, okay. And then,
but who knows? Under radio, under the discount state, I might have started being imprecise in my right hemisphere.
Okay. And then you go to say that the only strategy we have now is to spread this thing quickly. We have to get rid of the present government of Canada, and set up a monarchy because the future is bringing in the anti-Bob forces. They must be infiltrated. Not just the future, but all futures. This is serious. The only way to do this, that is to make me King of Canada so I can work in the secret Venetian blind systems of the Council of Ten, which Wyndham LaRouche is talking about.
Are you quoting me literally? Did I say Venetian blind?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's Venice. And they had what was called the Secret Council of Ten. That was the star chamber that would assassinate people, you know, the secret government. And, so I must have just, under the right hemisphere effect, just kind of started improvising. So I called the Venetian blind.
Okay. Yeah, you're talking so fast, it was probably right hemisphere.
I'm trying to get it all on record.
I've
got a few minutes.
Yeah.
It's my press conference.
Yeah. So then you said the Queen disappeared a long time ago. That she's not a human being, she's a hologram. That's why we can't touch her, because if you touch her, there's nothing there. With the Queen a hologram, Reagan a double, the Pope a Russian clone, organic robotoid. I lost my place. Whoops. Oh, okay. And then, where does that leave you, the listener, who's everywhere, actively and passively on the planet at the speed of light? You say that all the time now.
Yeah.
This important fact.
I didn't cut it down. I was supposed to say the speed of thought, which McLuhan said was faster than the speed of light. So my Android meme concept is like going beyond the speed of light to the speed of thought.
Right.
Memes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a later insight by me in the early 90s. And this is 1984.
So the listener is everywhere, actively and passively on the planet at the speed of light. When you're
When I get on the radio a few years later, I'd be saying this stuff, and people had, what the fuck is he saying? They couldn't conceive what a discarded condition was. I thought it was so obvious. People were really puzzled. But all this stuff is obvious. It all came true. Then Ayn shows up to show what the Queen is. They're pretty well holograms. It could have got confirmed by Ayn, which is incredible. Or Ayn was humoring me and confirming my stuff to make me feel confident for my press conference. You know, who knows what's going on? What MK Ultra is happening here with Ayn?
Mm-hmm. But just more holograms now than
all
the Queen.
Possibilities. I'm willing to think all possibilities about what's going on. So what'd you say?
Oh, it said not only is the Queen a hologram, there's more holograms. Like, they're all holograms.
Because the hologram is the effect of the global theater. So I hadn't created the term holiopathic yet. That's done in New York in 93, 94 when Carolyn's doing Mir and we're forming a company to distribute Mir. What do we call it? And I put together homeopathy and the hologram came out with holiopathic. So that's created in 94 or 95. But I was thinking in 2007, Walter Boert dies, I think December 18th, and then end of May, after interviewing or being on Chad, we like to cite Chad was on University of Vancouver or Vancouver People's Radio, free radio, whatever you call it, community radio, talking about his album, which was inspired by Bob Knowledge, like we're hearing. And I was part of the dialogue, and then the next day we flew from New York to L.A. And Then we spent No, that was in 2007. We go to L.A. And then 2 weeks there. No, we go to we go to L.A. for 5 weeks. Carolyn spends all 5 weeks. I do 2 weeks, then go to New Zealand to see Andrew Crystal. And we're talking about moving to Costa Rica. So Walter dies while I'm there with Andrew Crystal. And so I reconnect with James. Well, he met once before in 2005 in those pictures at Jerry Fialka's Finning's Wake Group meeting. Spend Christmas Eve and a bunch of days, which gets taped by the host and hostess of the place we stayed in. But the important point is I go back to New York on December 29th, and a couple weeks later I start being on James' show, but we decide, let's go back. I'll wait to go to Costa Rica in Maui. So that's in end of May, and that's when I'm on the radio with Chad, May 2008. And we go visit Walter Board's Russian doctor friend, a nice lady. And that's where James channels Walter for 5 hours, for freak's sake. Didn't see that coming. And in the channeling, and I think I mentioned this last week at Office Hours, sorry for the repeat, you may not have heard it, Walter says through James, he says, you will meet with the Queen, and she'll have an important question for you, and you'll give her the answer that will solve her problem. And that fucking happened, for fuck's sake. That's 2007 and 2008, and we could say it happened 14 years later, 2022, 2021, whenever JW started going to Buckingham Palace. So, isn't that incredible? Look at that, people. Fucking forward. He saw the actual future. The next day, we're driving down the street. And I remember driving along some major LA highway and looking up and seeing the J. Paul Getty Museum up on a hill, and then turning and looking at James, and he starts talking, and Walter Boer's coming through again. And while he's driving down the highway, it was a short contact, and Walter says, Bob, in 100 years, there will people be making paintings and drawings and cartoons about you. Now, he knew about the Church of Genius, so I don't think he was referring to that. But he predicted that. And, of course, we all know that's going to happen. So pretty interesting what came through James, through Boer. Okay, next
okay.
Phenomenal fucking thing.
Okay, you said, this is an important fact of super angelization.
Yeah, so explain that, how humans are super angels and angels can't be super angels.
Right.
Yeah, that's a major thing. Only I got from McLuhan. No one else ever discussed that or noticed it.
Right. And then you said, Marshall McLuhan, how can you be in two places at once, only under electronic conditions? When you're everywhere, you're in the whole universe. That's why people take heroin. They want to be put on the whole universe. They want to put on the whole universe.
Yeah, that's right. That's in the William Burroughs Review, December 64 in Nation magazine, where Marshall says that LSD creates consumerist visions, you know, visual mosaics and wonderful imagery. So it's a more eye-based thing, even though you get acoustic hallucinations, but it's visual. But heroin is not an image hallucinogenic byproduct. You don't get imagery, apparently. You just feel tremendously good. And so Marshall said, that's feeling the whole universe. You're wearing the whole universe. And heroin gives you that feeling. And I don't know if he said it then, because he does mention the global membrane, but we're going to move into digital media, where with social media, Web 2.0, everybody wears the whole media universe. So they're all doing a technical or tech body version of heroin. That's what's important there. And now I don't think I have that idea about social media, because there wasn't any social media in 84. But I thought just general broadcast media made you huge and tiny at the same time, you know, subatomic and macrocosmic. And the dimensions of that make humans super angels. They're everywhere. Whereas angels, they're pretty cool, but they can only be at one place and then go somewhere else. They're more mobile than humans, interdimensionally, and they can only, and they have to do it sequentially. Now, what happens to angels under electric conditions? Well, non-physical. The guff gets eroded. So the angels are getting eroded. They being some aspect of non-physical, not completely. They're not just non-physical, apparently. Chad recently found out that in the archives that all technology was created by angels. So I need to go back and listen to my...
And the human body.
What?
And the human body.
What about the human body?
The angels created it, made it.
Is that right? Well, it's a technology. It's a certain, you know, level of distortion. So that makes sense. But the Deb West had a private session, and at the end of it, during our talking with JW or the impressions, but maybe Ian is still there. I bring up the whole thing about technology, and I have a theory about angels and technology, I think. And so I got to go listen to that and see what I said in light of what Chad said. But I intuited back then, whenever that private session with Deb West was. And we used to sell it. She didn't mind her private session going up, but for the angel stuff, at the end that I talk about, we would say, you know, you got to buy this to get that. So I'm discussing that. You begin to talk about being everywhere at once by saying you're in the person you're talking to on the phone, and they're in your place, and you're in their place, and if you're tapped, that was the joke, if you're tapped by the CIA, you're in all the CIA agents' home.
Right.
They're in your home. So where are you? And that's what you quoted me saying an hour ago. Like I was saying, you know, everything is a hologram and robots everywhere. Where are we? Where are you? Well, that experience you would get, I understood, as the heroin effect. But it's more passive. Now, you could talk and dominate that global membrane if you were on the electric media. But it's analog media. It's not the multiple two-way, multi-way of digital media. That comes later. And an interesting thing is that in the mid-90s, during Web 1.0, Michael Blake Reed came out of some session. It might have been with McLuhan. And he was talking about what he got in his, quote, dreams. And he said, McLuhan was showing me all these people talking, millions of people just talking, and nobody listening to anybody, but everybody kind of broadcasting and talking. And it was a description of what would come 10 years later, you know, with YouTube and blog posts and what are they called, blogcasts or something. All that stuff, it was not there in the early 90s when Mike had this vision. And while he was talking, while McLuhan was talking to me, Michael would perceive that McLuhan was talking to him in his trance dream state. So that was a tremendous prediction. And probably influenced me. It got me thinking about this heroin effect or something in the populace, technically, not by drugs, but by media. Okay? So there's that one.
Okay. So then Bob Box asks you, Bob, talk about the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Talk about the 1907 panic. And then
that's
start
Nelson.
Talking.
He liked to talk about the 1907 financial. That's when the city of London took over America. They've been working on it since the Gold Species Act in 1879 or something. But that's leading up to the Federal Reserve. income tax and whatever else they did in 1913. So they exploited the collapse of the economy in 1907. And mm-hmm. so Nelson was reading that in LaRouche books and stuff. So he liked to talk about that.
Yeah, the final coup started with the anti-Lincoln forces in the Civil War.
Yeah.
And then you said, I infiltrated the banking organizations in the 40s. The Men in Black was always, is the best you can describe at the highest level of negotiations.
I call them the Men in Black?
Yeah.
That's intuiting the alien presence at the top. Because the Men in Black are the legendary weirdos that come around and harass UFO abductees. They wear all black and they don't seem human, but they're human. They look human. And that's a legend, the Men in Black. And, you know, there's even a movie, a famous movie called Men in Black,
right.
I think. So they were the, like the FBI, CIA, secret agents monitoring the UFO revelations and controlling them. And I'm talking about that, eh? The men in,
yeah,
the highest levels of the Secret Council 10, you encounter Men in Black.
Yeah, and that any banker or CIA officer who speaks looks for a nod from the Men in Black.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're leaders of the old gods.
Well, that's the Greek in Greek mythology. You have the Titans, which Ian was just explaining the other day in Burt's inventory of the origins of our world with the Amicalites and my buddies from Alpha Centauri and all that stuff we did last week that Burt found.
Right.
That would get into what you just said, which was what?
That the Men in Black were leaders of the old gods.
Yeah. And so, that's Bob Dobbs knowledge there in 84. Mm-hmm. You know, that goes beyond Bar Marshall's International Connection stuff. But I was there. I had to get it all out.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good.
You said my leader Jehovah is dealing with this exceedingly. Who's that?
In the Church of Genius, Bob was influenced by Yahweh One, which was a way of interpreting the four letters that meant Jehovah or God. What's his name? Brian can probably elaborate on that. So, yeah, I'm talking about Yahweh One. So, you know, it's interesting. I'm Bob Dobbs, or my father is, but I'm acting it out. And when the first opportunity came to fucking do it, I did it right there on October 1st, 1984. I laid out the J.R. Bob Dobbs knowledge. I was explaining where Stang and them got their information from my files, which is in Memo to Prince Charles, 1990, I think, June 4th, 1990. That's in the back of the Fatty Communion book, where I explain after the nuclear first strike in September 82, I could then leave Dallas and go up to Toronto and be with Carolyn. She was already there. And I left the archives, and Stang and them ransacked the archives in late 82, early 83, and produced the Book of the Subgenius in the fall of 1983. It was from my archives. Which would be the holy offices and all that. And you can see, you definitely see aspects of May Braswell, LaRouche, Beter, even McLuhan's Tetrad in the Book of the Subgenius. It's like half, it's done by someone looking at my archives on acid, you know? So that's amazing.
Yeah.
Hopefully this inspires Brian, who's heard this story like five times, say some new stuff. We repeat the ritual and new insights come out. Yeah, next.
Okay, so Jack Nicholson comes in.
No, James Kidney, he can do Jack Nicholson. So he suddenly becomes Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, definitely.
He complains about, do you have some lines there?
And then he came in and you said, you've done bad work recently for the church, but you're paying
your
bills.
Wait, I missed what you said. Do it again.
You've done bad work recently for the church, but you're paying your bills. What do you have to say about
that? Am I saying that or is Jack Nicholson saying that?
You said this.
I'm putting down Jack Nicholson. I'm saying you did bad work lately, but you paid your bills.
Yeah. And like, what do you have to say about your recent Rolling Stone interview?
Rolling Stone interview with Jack Nicholson. Okay. Yeah.
The play, and then you start talking about the play called Who's Forgot Furry Lint?
Who's Forgotten Furry Lint?
Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? And it's going to be an extraordinary bomb.
Now, wait a minute. Did I say Hand Signals for the Blind or Who's Forgotten Furry Lint?
Who's Forgotten Furry Lint?
Yeah, okay. But that was a spinoff of what I did in 76 called Hand Signals for the Blind, which I discussed with McLuhan back then in 76. And that is discussed. I sent the story to Cameron and he wrote about it last week. But he deleted some of the sentences. I didn't like that. So I have to complain to Cameron, do not fuck with what I send you. Because Cameron wanted to emphasize the hand signals. And he does a whole think piece on the hand signals. And I sent him my interview in 2005, that documentary, 34 Minutes, where Jerry Fialka's taking me around L.A. and I'm doing radio and art galleries and speaking all over the place. We just reposted that. Cameron saw that. He wrote back, great stuff. But I disagree with a lot of what you say, especially on this quote. It's a long quote. I think it's about computers managing the global environment that McLuhan talks about in Playboy magazine in 69. So he wants me to call him up and I guess record an argument or debate about what I say, even though he likes what I say. It's fantastic. But technically, he has to disagree. And he says it's the old disagreement we've always had. So that's the result of... So that was originally called Hand Signal for the Blind. And then because of the Larry Flint Rebel magazine fiasco and all that happened there in late 83, early 84, and Flint starts running for president, I make an update or add to Hand Signals for the Blind. And I remember that's happened in by 1990. No, I'm saying Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? So now I did it in 84, I guess. But Jerry starts visiting in Jerry Fialka in 1990-91. And I remember explaining to him how I did the Holy Offices and made a play out of it called Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? Furry Lint being an inverse of Larry Flint. And the idea is that all the Holy Offices, they were just lint on the fabric of America. Or as Zappa said, a pimple on the face of America. And the men in black could just whisk them off like wiping some lint off your suit or something. So Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? Larry Flint was the archetype of what happened to the other Holy Offices. Or the Holy Offices. He wasn't the Holy Office. So I remember reading the play to Jerry on my balcony up back at 122 Ellsworth. And the punchline, I won't go into it, is Zappa. His friend Zappa. So there I am mentioning the fucking title, but it's never discussed ever again with anybody until Jerry comes, because I want him to be intrigued by the punchline about Zappa. So I don't know if I... But we did, wait a minute, we did do Who's Forgotten Furry Lint, the radio show in August 88. So that's 4 years later. So the title was used. We put out the cassettes of the 3 hours and 45-minute performance. I think it's October. It's August 28, 88, me and Neufeld. But I don't think I discussed the play aspect. I wanted to keep that secret. But I did read it to Jerry when he showed up 2 years later in 1990. So It's good to hear me. I had that idea pretty quickly to describe what happened to Mae Brussels and everything. It was an inside story, you know. Hearing Mae weekly talk about it, at least to me privately on the phone, was real. Secret Council 10 worked because I was in the Secret Council 10 still. I was a worker in the Secret Council 10 in 83, 84. Okay, next.
Okay, then you said, let's talk about the problems I've got, or the problem I've got. If you guys aren't supporters of me, I have to start all over again. It's a 40-year plan. I've been usurped in Dallas by the TVJR. What I need is support. If you could start raising money, or at least dope and weapons is the main agent for funds in politics. If you could get this thing going, you could have me king by November 24th.
Yeah, because Mulroney is going to be elected for the first time in that election. And I think John Turner, the liberal guy, was running against him. And then some woman replaced her, unless that was a later election. But Mulroney, this is very accurate. This is the beginning of, you know, in a way, 1984 acting out. The world becomes a real fucked up place from from the 80s on. And, you know, tax derivatives, virtual economy comes in, and the world is white, squared. The disappearance of the world happens again, you know, through the Android meme. And I'm preparing everybody. Now, okay, I'm saying that. Now, I'm never going to be on the radio again. So where are these people supposed to do that? How is this a no-vote, for fuck's sake? And then 3 fucking years later, the opportunity rises, and I've got my rap down. I didn't realize it about hearing this. I fucking said already what I was going to do if given the opportunity on the media, but I didn't know if I did. Why would I be on? Bob Marshall was what John Judge and Anton Leo liked. They liked the practical news journalism of it. They didn't want fucking a whack job. I was trying to be king, and I had to be king by November 84. I had like 6 weeks to pull this off. That's pretty funny. Lucky I got on the radio. If I had to pull this off, how come I didn't do anything? Although I was the Secret Council 10 that we were doing something, but if Bob Marshall hadn't gotten out of the radio, there would be no Chris Toomey, and Chris Toomey wouldn't have asked us about the Church of Peace, and I would have been on blabbing away. So again, I was meant to be on to get the electric effect so I could become king in 84. Now, did I become king? Yeah, maybe. Behind the scenes, Bob Marshall was taking over Toronto Radio. So,
I think so.
Good.
Yeah, I think who else became king? You know, you have the, if anyone became king, you have the best, you have the most sophisticated claim.
Yeah, and the most populist. More and more people heard it, they would all agree. Yeah, Bob's king. Now, this is all happening before Stang is on the radio. He doesn't get on the radio till 85. What'd you say, Brian?
I was saying, really? Wow.
Yeah. Well, we beat Stang. And what he did, he had some friends, those guys who've been on KPFA for years. Maybe it's puzzling evidence in those guys.
Yeah.
They had a show. They were on a guy named Bob Nelson's show. And Stang met these guys, you know, in 82, 83, when they started reading the Church of Genius stuff and getting into it and going to the Bibles. And he went out and was on Bob Nelson's show. So he got on the radio like I did in 84, in 83. So you could say he beat me there. But
that's what I was thinking. I knew that there was at least a Subgenius radio show before 85, so that's why I was puzzled. But that
makes sense. Again? You knew what? There was
That there was some Subgenius show on the radio before then.
Before Stang?
Just before 85. So,
and
he didn't have his own show till 85. That makes sense.
Yeah. But you knew there were some guys in San Francisco or someplace. Part of it, sort of. Yeah, and I don't know how much Subgenius stuff they were doing in 83, but let's assume they were because they had Stang on and they knew about him and they were somehow colleagues. So, but here's the incredible thing. The host is Bob Nelson. Okay?
Yes.
That's the witnesses that Nelson used to think is what Dylan was thinking about in All Along the Watchtower. Two riders or writers come approaching, whatever that line is. Later, I decided it was me and Carol. So Bob Nelson, okay, this is the language pointing out something.
That's
basically
funny.
I am the Church of Subgenius, you know, the real ground of it. And if Stang is going to be on the radio, become discarnate, which was a big deal back then to get on electric media, it's going to be under my sponsorship. So the host has to be Bob Nelson. This is incredible. That's exegesis worthy of the new criticism, Brian, out of Yale.
Sure.
Yeah.
Paying careful attention to every detail, including the allegedly unintentional ones, like the artist's name that they didn't design themselves.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's Bob's anachrony after the yin-yang. So he, sometime in 85, he gets on some station, you know, a populist community kind of station, I think it is. It's not university connected like my station, the Ryerson, but he starts his show in 85, and he starts the Hour of Slack. And the timing is interesting, and the Bob Nelson thing. I don't know. I would have typed that into All Slack at some point, would have pointed this out to them, but they don't acknowledge it. Now, here's what did happen in 81, 82. I've mentioned this. There's a early Hour Slack recording, which was probably broadcast in 85, 86, 87, but it was sold by Stang because it existed before the Hour Slack because it was from a DeBible. And it sounds like it's at the end of the DeBible and the subgenius are sitting around ranting and talking to each other. And one guy suddenly says, well, the real battle coming or happening is between the subgenius, or maybe he says subgenie, and the subdinis. That's fucking incredible. Why would he say that? You know, there was no Bob Dean in their awareness at that time. But there's the language. They're channeling, in which a lot of artists channeling. You know what I mean? It's angels introducing new technologies. So, you know that story, right, Brian? We've talked about that before. What happened to Brian?
Oh, yes.
You knew that story, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, about the guy saying subdinis, for sure.
Yeah, it's amazing. You've got to be impressed with this stuff. Of course, it's expanded into the whole history of Ulfinell's life now. It's huge now, but the inklings were there. The submissions, the effects preceding the causes. It's incredible. And this is why we're spending this time, so Greg Duffel can be educated on what he's part of. We have to help him recover from the Russia effect. And so he may have even heard these stories before. But we'll really put it all in one big chunk. We'll sell this, make recording and sell it. But the important thing is how this was anticipated, Brian, in this October 1st, 84 thing. I never had a chance to really collectively or publicly evaluate and be impressed with this thing. I knew it had happened, but it's good details, Brian. You never heard this. You might have heard that recording, but you don't think about it this way. I mean, I went through it, and I made a list. I think I've got 200 items on that for me in my list of the content of that 25 minutes of talking. If not 200, it's 100. It's a big number of thieves. So how many have you got? Is there a lot more?
There's a couple left.
Okay, let's hear a
couple lines. He said there's no more actors.
Yeah, now what were you just speaking about?
That you said...
Oh, make me a king. Make me
a
king.
You make me king, all that
yeah. Stuff. Yeah. Now, this next point, there are no more actors.
Everybody's
really
dead.
Important.
It's the planet of the dead.
Yeah, quoting McLuhan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then going on along, you said, we don't need a democracy, we need a monarchy. We will be having regional monarchies under the government of Auntie Bob. It's important.
That's biblical. Now, what that is that's Herbert W. Armstrong. The 10 kings of Europe come in with the Antichrist, and the Pope is part of the Antichrist, but the Antichrist is a military leader. It could be Trump. And the military leader recovers from a grievous wound, and so he's okay at the beginning, but then he fucks up. 3 years of good rule, and then 3 years of bad rule. 3.5 years, total 7 years. But it's the Vatican from the Protestant fundamentalist point of view. The Vatican, the military leader, and the retrieval of the Holy Roman Empire and the 10 monarchies of history, the 10 kings. So, in a way, my 10 holy offices is an environment to that part of the Antichrist. And so, what am I saying? Could you repeat what you said? I said,
we don't need a democracy; we need a monarchy. We will be having regional monarchies under the government of Auntie Bob. It's important we put on a fake. Oh, sorry.
Oh yeah, go ahead. And
put on a fake of the King of Canada so we can enter the councils and discussion like they did with Hitler in 1944, attempted to blow him up at the discussion. We won't fail this time. I'll be ready for the X's coming in December.
I'll be ready for what?
The X's.
The X's. I claim they're coming in December.
And then that was it. That was the end.
What?
That was the end of the 20 minutes you were on the radio.
Right. Fantastic. And it's well known the 10 kings are part of the fundamentalist interpretation of the book of Revelation, And so I'm telling people we're in the end times, though Ian came along to correct it. It's not the end times, it's the end of time.
Mm.
But a lot of Ion, builds on that. And what I said there, but what's incredible is I'd say, look at that, Brian, was I fucking ready? Give me the mic. I'll fucking tell you some shit. I had no access to the mic. Bob Barnes would be, but I didn't. But all of a sudden I'm on there. And I get to say this in the big year, 1984. And much of what's happened with the Secret Council Triune, the Vatican, the fucking palace in Washington, D.C., that was the Illuminati running the world economy, the secret part, that has the monarchies in there. I was anticipating what I learned from Ion there. Incredible. And, Ion said that I fucked up people's minds in Toronto in that period and other stuff. I had forgotten what was on this. What I'm saying I did, it happened right there on October 1st. I eventually get paranoid and start smacking Nelson and James around because I fear that they're going to kill me any minute on the air. I turn on the two of them, which is funny. And so, going into the secret councils as a monarch, that's what happened. I'm in there now, talking to everybody, the elite, of Pinkland, and they're talking to JW and me, and they're the kings, the modern oligarchs, and we're in there fucking with them, and they're dropping dead. Unbelievable. You get that, Brian? This is uncanny. This is approaching the greatest art form right here with that, what I'm saying and what unfolds. And you should be renewed in your awe, Brian.
Is that why they were calling you Crazy Bob?
I was always considered that. Back in the 60s, people thought I was on speed.
Oh.
I didn't understand that. I didn't know why, but that was the gossip about me. I found that out later. Bob's on speed. So, yeah, I talk fast. Crazy Bob.
Oh, pardon.
Yeah, Brian, what the fuck are you doing?
You
hear attention.
Well, sure, the awe is renewed. I mean, although
it's not that much of a surprise. I certainly, you know, the idea that you were intuiting all this ion stuff ahead of time, or that, you know, that's certainly, I've certainly noticed that before, or even that, that ion almost seemed to retrieve your whole, output and emphasize the part that people like myself weren't emphasizing, because I'm like a big McLuhan head. I'm like more McLuhan than Krishnamurti or something. And I'm more, you know, that I'm more Croker than Herbert Armstrong or something. the aspects of everything that you had talked about before that were sort of underrepresented among some of your
underrepresented.
Yes. Or underappreciated by some of your fans and I became retrieved and or mega extended by ION.
Yes. Now this you just said it once, Kate, but then you have written there are no more actors. Remember, McLuhan said the global theater, the satellite, makes everybody an actor, everybody's crew, and there's no audience. In a sense, you know, nobody's really listening. And he has that back in Explorations in the '50s. He says, "Is anybody listening?" You know, nobody was. As the population got more into talk radio and just more access immediately to the Android meme situation and talking around it in and of it. So. So I used to claim that McLuhan was the greatest actor of his time, even though he was a lousy actor in normal context. For example, the day that Howard Hughes died, April 5th, 1976, some Italian theater people had visited the center. So they were there that Monday night. And after I was talking to them, they told me that they were trying to get McLuhan to do some acting or some script with them, and they were filming it, but they said he was too bad. You know, he can't act. And what that, I guess I would interpret that, he can't put on pink fucking knowledge. That's bullshit. But he can do his stuff, and it's a new level of acting. It's macroscopic gesticulation that he's mirroring. And I used to say, similar to me, I can't sing one fucking song, and I can't remember it. But I can sing Zappa stuff and remember Zappa lyrics. That's because it's fucking worthy of my hearing and participating in. So McLuhan is not going to act at in Hollywood. He's going to influence Jack Nicholson, who said he was. And I didn't know James could do Jack Nicholson, but it's very appropriate to have Nicholson on there. I don't even know if I ever said this to James, because Nicholson praised McLuhan. He said from Cliché Archetype in the early 70s, in some interview, you know, in the mid-70s, he said, that really changed my idea of how to act. So he's influenced by McLuhan. And a lot of other Hollywood people, Norman Lear, you know, director, becomes a McLuhanite. And Terry McLuhan's a good friend of Norman Lear, who I guess died recently. But McLuhan is the greatest actor. He's an anti-environment actor. He's an anti-actor. But he talks about what is worth noting and acted out theatrically, themes that are more relevant today than any fucking theme from Kubrick or anybody else who did movies that come and go and are famous for 15 minutes. None of them have the power of what McLuhan says. And McLuhan is obsolete compared to Bob Knowles. But anyways, give him his due. He is the actor that people study. The people fucking watch Jack Nicholson, you know, Chinatown or something and quote it, with their friends for a couple of minutes, but they don't judge their life and how they're doing and get depressed about the world situation by listening to Chinatown or watching it, but they might with McLuhan. So all media, all utterances were theater. And so if you cover it all, you're the greatest actor, which he did. So there's an important point that I hadn't had a chance to say, but that's what I'm saying in that thing there. I didn't get a chance to maybe spell it out, but there are no more actors. And then I would claim that I'm the final actor, or Iandom is, which pisses off Mark Stallman and fucking Greg and
Clinton and all the idiots. They don't understand what we're doing. Did you see April 29th? A Southern company announced another goddamn fucking nuclear reactor. Okay? There's beautiful photographs, so look at that. Look at the link I posted. Look, buddy, get fucking serious. Adam Pugin, get fucking serious. You know, the video. A video that Mark has put out, the Center for Digital, the Study of Digital Life or something. So there's some place, through Trey, through Pulsating Shadow, I wonder if he's listening, Pulsating Shadow on his site, he had a link to the digital place, and I went there, and there's all this video that he's been making. Well, his first video is with Adam Pugin, who influenced and gets a nod in Adam's PhD done a few years ago. And so it's like 2020 maybe, when this video was done. And Adam gives a bit of his history. I didn't know this. Adam Pugin, who's now in trouble fucking due to shit down in Houston, some kind of trouble. I don't know if we've talked about that. Clinton told me about it. He's got fucked up, younger than millennials, the alpha generation, complaining about his teaching McLuhan stuff. They're accusing him of being anti-Protestant. The student made a documentary and got other students to agree that, yeah, this fucking guy, he's anti, it's a Catholic university, but he's anti-Protestant. It's supposed to be open here. Back to Adam Pugin. So he explains, Mark gets him to explain where he came from in that. Well, he says that he came from Jordan Peterson, and then he adds the dark web people, the rebel wisdom, John Verbeke and other guys that are interviewed, the Weinstein brothers. You know these guys, Brian, right? That whole gang of people. Adam was influenced by them, and then he was reading Carl Jung, and he says, I wasn't doing McLuhan yet. So he discovers McLuhan for some reason, and he says, you know, I listening to Mark, I realized that McLuhan wasn't Jung. I thought he was more like a Jungian, maybe because he used the word archetype. But totally uninformed and naive little fucking Adam, vulnerable to Mark Solomon's nonsense. So I don't listen to 15 minutes of it or something. I'll listen to the rest of it later, but Adam is going to explain some paper. I think I've seen the paper he wrote, applying Mark's Thomas Aquinas bullshit about the inner senses. And Mark is on there introducing Adam by saying, they had a big conference in Toronto, the Toronto School of Communication in 2016, and everybody's there, and there's a big picture of everybody, and Mark's there. And Mark meets the Turkoff and all these people. Don't know, think he had much interaction before that. And the fake explorations Facebook page comes out of that. And everybody was all enthusiastic. Alex Kuskus was a member of it and all these people. But Alex told me later that Mark drove everybody like he did back at Lance Strait 18 years before. Mark's just is too fanatic about his stuff. But he's explaining what his stuff is. So in 2015, he forms the digital thing. And then I think the conference is in 2016, but maybe it's 2015. And he's met Adam and he's made some friends. So I don't know how much he's talking. Yes. So he says they decide to bring back McLuhan and really develop McLuhan. And Mark says, as they read McLuhan, at least he says that he discovered, but he pretends it's a we discovered that McLuhan knew nothing about psychology and that he was fucked up. And actually, we couldn't use him. So we had to do research into the history of psychology, which had been bad for 100 years. And Mark discovered faculty called faculty psychology. It's Thomas Aquinas derived psychology. And so he goes back, it's like maybe what they had 200 years ago. And he says they retrieved that. They said, this is the McLuhan knowledge. This is the knowledge that makes McLuhan relevant, because Mark says McLuhan was a failure. And
and we're left with nothing, but we found faculty psychology so we can, in a way, resuscitate McLuhan, improve on him, and forget about him. And so he says all that bullshit about the inner senses that Thomas Aquinas talked about, imagination, memory, cognitive something, and something else, four parts of the inner sensory life. And to think that McLuhan didn't talk about imagination or memory or the other two things, the drama of cognition, you're fucking nuts. You haven't studied McLuhan. You haven't taken it in. So McLuhan is relevant because he did talk about psychology, even though psychology was erased, being part of the chemical body brain. And there was a new psychology, which were the archetypes of the media unconscious, page 31 of Counterblast magazine. So he defines media as the archetypes of the social unconscious. So all that's not understood by Marx. Anyways, I see the limitations Adam brought to the McLuhan scene, and he was young and he was vulnerable. And so he speaks about the meaning crisis, which is what Verbeke and the Rebel Wisdom guys are into, the meaning crisis, okay, the content crisis. So that's where Adam is thinking from when he wrote his PhD, which I read. And I was willing to discuss with him, but he wouldn't talk to me about it. I would have pointed out the errors in the Mark Salman part of his thesis that he uses. So he knows that, so that he won't talk to me about it. So back to, I guess, why am I telling you that? We finished doing the inventory. Brian, and we did Brian there. I think I'm finished. Other than I talk about the obsolescence of Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, Edmund Husserl, anybody else back then, derivatives of Freud. And then you get to the postmodern guys, the structuralists and post-structuralists. And then I mentioned, and the faculty psychology of Mark Salman. So I list the obsolescence of the schools of psychology that McLuhan is aware of and leads to the tech body. Remember, McLuhan gets the credit for being the first and only of his contemporaries to really intuit the tech body. And so I wrap that up. So that's the first time I publicly list Mark's stuff as part of a historical dream, and we put it in the dustbin of history. Did you say something, Brian?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So, sorry, what is this? That was two hours and 18 minutes, or 2 hours and 20 minutes. So, sorry. I'm done. Thank you very much. Tremendous. Take on what you did. You made a very important broadcast here.
It all started because I asked you, when was the first time you were on the radio?
Yeah, this whole thing came from that question. So I had to explain, you know, how we got on CKLN and then what happened. I said, first time on the radio turned out to be pretty significant. And I said, go listen to it. And then you did. You told me to listen to it. And I said, did you take notes? And I think you said you did. Or you said, no, I'm going to go back and take notes. And that's what we listened to, your inventory.
But
I'm going to look up my list that I made for the show, wherever it is. Hopefully I'll find it. And then we'll read that out, all the things I noticed about.
So were you predicting all of this? Or was you saying all this, like, activated it all?
That's a good point. Never been said before. That's I would say I caused all this, and I still have to make some decisions to determine where the world's going to go now. Openel is like the fulcrum of everything. He started, and he's going to finish it. So what he says is the ground of everything. And so that's Lockdown Bob Rule, which I said, but I didn't know it meant that. And I am cautious about what I say, or I'm not trying to be an egomaniac or a cult or anything, but Ian says obedience is better than sacrifice, and they're trying to kill me, so I better be obedient and pretend I'm making these decisions. But we'll see. I need to talk to JW and Ion over the next week or so. Hopefully he'll be available. He says he would be. To catch up. I'm fucking 2 or 3 months behind in questions and what's been going on that I'm not aware of. Other than I don't need to be aware of it because it's all about me, for fuck's sake, all the time. Or counts. So what the hell are you going to do about that? Is Pulsating Shadow on the chat line? Any infiltrators there, Brian? Do you see anybody?
Oh, I don't have that window open, actually. I'm still just getting settled in at my house.
Okay, well, I'll look. What do we got here? Do I have to renew it? Yeah, looks like we've got to renew it.
Well.
Okay, I'll unmute everybody in a minute. What'd you say, Brian?
That's remarkable. I missed the beginning of that. I wasn't sure what we were inventorying. Obviously you just said it was first time you're on the radio. But that's great stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty
amazing. I'm grateful.
Okay. So is Eben here? It says here you have, Yuri posts the music, the album covers. Then it says 1991 Bob. Maggie says Exus, Korean Airlines Flight 007. Leon says, let's go to the deep with Eben. Megaflow says Elmo. Hi, Bob. Happy May Day. We made it again. I'm checking in. I'll be back around 9 p.m. I'm so happy today. Could that be Clinton? But they call themselves Megaflow, whatever that is. Then Maggie says, let's go to the deep with Eben. Eben in the house. Then Leon says, Maggie, the fourth world is still the electric environment, satellite conditions, battle of the harvest moon. Leon says, Renee and Joyce reading the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mega says, elect-ion. Elect-ion. Election. Elect-ion. Yeah. That's a good one. Then Maggie says, Ginsburg, and that's B-E-R-G, Maggie, not B-U-R-G, was a NAMBLA member. I wouldn't hug him either. Yeah. And so was Peter Lamborn Wilson. Then she corrects the spelling. Then Yarmulke. That's right. The Yarmulke continent. That's the name I forgot. Then Minimax is an hour ago. Not only did no one get that from McLuhan, Virgilia went so far as to wonder why no one had ever theorized technology in terms of angels. That's interesting. No one got the tech body from McLuhan, is what you're saying, Brian.
Well, it was you had just said, yeah, I was talking about super angelism and how we have the new technologies have given us access to this super angelic state that even angels can't. Us fools rushed into where angels aren't even capable of treading. And McLuhan just talked about angelism and you took it further to talk about super angelism and no one got that out of McLuhan. And it just, reminded me.
He said it once or twice, Brian. He said it once or twice. I heard it because I did the archives and that's a very good point. Nobody knows that one. So I mentioned it and I know it by 84. 40 fucking years ago, I know it. But as Ion has said that he knew that this technology had come alive. He says that in 1968 in the Playboy interview, assuming it was dictated in 68 and published in 69.
So,
but he says it's one piece in the Global Village. Get this. Technology is coming alive. What?
Go ahead. Finish what you said.
Technology's coming alive. He lays that out before most people. And then I says he really understood that and saw it was coming and got really close to the incredible tech body, which we're in the middle of. So that's what you're pointing out here. No one got that from him. We'll have to look up what Virilio said about this.
at this point, but he comes after McLuhan.
And long after you. You know, you're saying that in 1984, whereas then along comes Virilio sometime in the like late 90s or mid 2000s, talking about things with his students and how actually, you know, the modern technology creates a situation that's similar to how they said angels could be in more than one place at once. And Virilio's like, why is this completely unexplored in philosophy?
Maybe you should have put this read in McLuhan.
There's a whole... Maybe, Paul, Virilio, maybe you should have finished reading McLuhan. There's a whole book. Angelism is a big theme in the Global Village, but okay, sure. Go on with your students about how no one's ever explored this.
That's right. And here's, and who said it all? Fucking me, before anybody. I even predicted the fucking reunification of Germany, for fuck's sake. I cheated. I went to non-physical and got that from Evergreen, but, well, doing research, you know, you gotta be careful how you limit yourself. So the point is, I fucking said everything before anybody. And that's why I say me and Nelson sparked the McLuhan revival. We did.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. You know, you could say on the non-physical level, or is this a collection of subconscious, if humans are constantly really, supposedly, communicating to each other and in touch and aware of each other some way with our larger faculties, we're right there in the fucking middle of it, influencing everybody. So the first time I saw it was when in June when Tiananmen Square happened, and Newsweek or Time had a big article on it. This is, you know, they got massacred, the students, on June 4th, which is always the dates of the memos, Rene's birthday. They have Marx versus McLuhan. And that, for me, and I sort of track the magazine world a lot, and McLuhan had not been discussed for many years, 10, 15 years, not make a headline like that. And it all came back. And then Marchand, interestingly, capitalized on it because he had worked in Ottawa on the National Archives, organizing the archives that I pre-organized, some of it. He gets it in Ottawa in 85, 86, 87, and he's smart enough to take notes as he does it, and he creates a book that comes out in 89. And that would be, in the pink world, be considered the spark of McLuhanism, plus just the world, the magazines recognizing this is the Global Village, even though it isn't, it's the Global Membrane. And then Wired, after Mondo 2000 talks to us, that's where we had an influence, on the radio, Mary and Nelson are at the Mondo 2000 gang, Are You Serious, those guys, at George Lucas's house. And we talked to them on the show, which I've got to find where that is in the arc of the timeline. But I looked, I couldn't find it. So I don't know where it is or what happened. Maybe it happened after we stopped recording or something. It was a later thing. But I remember Michael being there, Michael Dyer. But the point is that we influenced the Mondo 2000. Now, I said some of this stuff last week, but this is one long, massive recording. So we'll repeat it just as because it's part of this theme. And, you know, Mary's on there, Mary McLuhan, where she's complimenting what me and Nelson have done with her. Maybe they had done the teacher awards in Ottawa and Mulroney went to it. I know we talked about it on the radio. It might have been the night with Mary McLuhan, but Mulroney came up to Mary and Nelson after because Nelson read the quote from one of the do lines where McLuhan says, Russia and China are doomed. They will not be separate, isolated communist states for much longer. McLuhan said that in 1970 or so. And so here it is, 1990, 20 years later, and Nelson read that quote from that particular do line. It's called The Russian Interview. He says in some professor interviews him, the whole issue is about Russia and or the Soviet Union, but I think it's called The Russia Interview. And Mulroney is attending this big gala where Mary's giving awards to interesting or excellent teachers. She did that for 25 years with Henry Kissinger, Vint Cerf, the father of the Internet, and Walter Cronkite on her board. So among the McLuhan children, she's the most successful in normal pink terms. She's out there with a big budget, getting the McLuhan word out there via these ridiculous teacher awards as the cover. So we're in Ottawa, and Maroney comes up and says, wow, McLuhan said that? I got to start reading McLuhan. That's what Maroney, the Antichrist, the Anti-Monarch, the Anti-Bob said to Nelson, who was Bob, so to speak. So that's important. So why am I talking about that? Brian, what evoked? How we experience McLuhan's arrival.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
we get Maroney going on McLuhan, and the Prime Minister, he's still Prime Minister at that point, and beginning to be disgraced. He's screwing up with the Meath Lake Accords and the NAFTA invasion. He's a dupe of that. Definitely, Beter said Canada was Bolshevik controlled. That's fucking Maroney. That's what he is, with his ambassador, Alan Goldsmith or something. Forget his name. He was the ambassador from around the world. The Canadian ambassador went to the White House during the Reagan era more than anybody else. Flew into that airport, Reagan Airport, Dulles Airport, whatever it is, more than anybody else. That was a historical statistic that came out at that time. Because the Canadian Bolsheviks were working with the Pentagon Bolsheviks to run Reagan of America. And that's the beginning of the bad times that I'm saying in 1984. It's all militarization from that point on in the early 80s. It's the Pentagon protecting themselves, clamping down in a losing game against the Christian Russians, the Skopsi that Beter talked about. And some guy wrote about secret stuff in the 80s, in the 30s. Matthew, he writes a book on the Skopsis, the secret Christian group that castrated themselves and knocked out the Tsar. They didn't like the Tsar and worked with the Bolsheviks, but then got ripped off by the Bolsheviks and suppressed by them. They toppled those guys in the 70s, and the Bolsheviks were exiled to America. They killed off the Rockefellers in the late 70s, early 80s. This is after the Battle of the Harvest Moon. And then take over America through Reagan. And, of course, the battle's right there with the half of the Reagan cabinet shooting Reagan, you know, one half shooting the other half. The Bolsheviks and Rockefellers in the same room. So with that Beter knowledge, that's influencing my thinking a lot there. Because what you have is the Pentagon basically couldn't knock out Russia. At least for a while, but they did their damnedest from the Pentagon, and there's a really good book by William Engdahl about how Bush, George Bush, who was president at the time, George Bush Sr., how he knocked down the Berlin Wall. It wasn't Gorbachev. It was a Bolshevik action to destabilize everything and then get back in there and have the financial oligarchs of Russia and all the crap that Russia went through for 20 years, and then the world did. That is a result of us stopping the Pentagon attempt to cause nuclear war one. And because that failed, they still were trying it, but they were weak, but they made it more vicious. And so the vicious world of America, supposedly, that Trump is trying to be a figurehead correcting, that is post-Dr. Beter. Even Beter even quits and gets into gold dealing on behalf of the Queen. And then I get involved with that in December 86. And then Beter is murdered in March 87. And then I take over the City Council 10 in March 88, actually February 24th. And I dismantle it in 1990. And then it's waiting for 20 years for lockdown Bob Rule. And not a good time for the world. So that's what I'm predicting there. I'm saying, get ready, dark times are coming in. I'm understanding dark times for North America, so to speak, as well as the rest of the world, but a new downer for North Americans who, the 70s were bad enough, but it was going to get really bad. Already farmers were a trend of committing suicide when I'm making that broadcast. So it's an important broadcast, right in tune, more negative than anybody would come up with. Way more than Christopher Hitchens or any negative guys.